The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Hello, I hope that everyone's doing well today. We are actually going to read out of the Oprah quarterly printed magazine today as much as possible. And the first thing is an opening article called Here We Go. A few years ago, Gail hosted a roundtable for Oprah Daily, and a guest said, "Gratitude is a posture of your heart, a choice, and a privilege." Now, you know how much I believe in the power of gratitude practice, and how I've kept a gratitude journal for decades. But that description stopped me in my tracks. Isn't it good? I just love how it makes clear that it's up to us to choose gratitude with an open heart, and to do so again and again. There's no better time to start, or restart, your own gratitude practice than during this busy holiday weeks. To help inspire you, we've got 6 writers on the unexpected things they give thanks for, plus a list of things, 112 favorite things, that is, starting on page 7, that you might be grateful for too. You'll also find our favorite books of the year to read and share, recipes to sweeten your holiday gatherings, and a cheat sheet for surviving the season, with a special focus on mothers-in-law. And last, but far from least, I appreciate you and wish you the blessing of the season, Oprah. This next article is Our Family Traditions. Oprah's not the only one with favorites during the holiday season. From classic movies to adorably ugly sweaters to home-baked treats, tried-and-true customs are their own cause for celebration, especially when shared with loved ones. We asked 3 families what traditions they most look forward to year after year, and what's topping their wish lists right now. Quali Tree Time. For 6 years running, the day after Thanksgiving is dedicated to finding and decorating our tree. It starts with an adventure at the tree farm where we play hide-and-seek and take turns cutting. Then we head home for a cozy decorating party in matching PJs bought or made special for this memorable event. That's with Duana, D-U-A-N-A, and Curtis. On our wish list, with a baby girl on the way, Duana and Curtis can't wait to gather their new family of 8, including the 2 Dogos, for a photo by this year's tree. And Dogos was D-O-G-G-O-S. Open house. We never lose sight of the fact that the holidays can be tough for many. Being a beacon of unconditional love for those who are struggling and displaced, and making sure everyone knows they can feel warm and welcomed in our home is the tradition I pray both our daughters carry forward as they grow older. Jamila and Quay, that's spelled Q-U-E. On our wish list, fingers and toes are crossed there will be play sets for the girls to share, pleated bow flats for Jamila, and a standing desk for Quay. Gimme some sugar. Making maple syrup has been a long-standing tradition in Jeffrey's family, and we know we wanted to pass it down to our son. Since 2015, we've sugared our own as gifts for loved ones and use it in just about everything we cook during the holidays, from turkey brine and salads to Christmas morning French toast. Ashley and Jeffrey. On our wish list, since their maple syrup business keeps them extra busy during the season, Ashley and Jeffrey just want a day off after Christmas to take in the sights at Rockefeller Center as a family. This article is on Beauty Talk, on everyone's lips. Carol Rashid, the head makeup artist on The Color Purple, gives us a peek behind the scenes and thanks to her new lipstick collection, a memento. How did you get your start in the makeup industry? I'm from a town in Florida where not a lot of people make it out successfully. I had a pretty good upbringing, but I made some not great choices. I had a baby when I was 15 and dropped out of high school. I worked at and got fired from Church's Texas Chicken. Then I got married, went back to school, and eventually landed a job at the Fashion Fair cosmetics counter. Honestly, I picked it because I could earn commission, but soon realized how much I loved beauty. Years later, I cold-called Disney World's cosmetology department. They gave me an interview, and I got a job styling the characters' wigs, which turned into running the makeup department at the Nickelodeon show called Double Dare, and then being the head makeup artist for the Oxygen Network, and then HSN. I've been doing this for 3 decades. When I look back to where I started, I used to be embarrassed. Now I'm proud. How did you land the Color Purple gig? I did 3 interviews with the director, Blitz Bazawule, and that's Bazawule, and created mood boards to show him how the character should look with color palettes for each. I even added music to my presentation. Blitz had such a strong vision for this movie, and it resonated with me so much that I wanted to jump through hoops for him. What was it like working behind the scenes? This movie inspired me more than any other project. It was challenging, and I poured a lot of myself into it. Just covering the tattoos on all the dancers was a huge team effort. I remember trying 10 different lip colors on Fantasia Barrino, who plays Miss Celia, in the beginning of the movie. I concealed her natural lip color. Then, as she evolved, I began to add in more and more color and sheen. Taraji P. Henson's character, Shug Avery, went from a monotone red to a stronger orangey red. But in a movie like this, I hope you don't really notice the makeup. It's there to help tell the story and to capture the essence of the characters. How did this experience inspire you to make a collection of lipsticks? I wanted to think of a way to pay homage to the strong women characters. Sophia, played by Danielle Brooks, remains resilient and has so much courage. Shug is inspiring. Celie never gives up hope. I thought of these traits as I created these creamy lip colors. Inspiration is an orange-red, like the hue Shug wears. Hope is a true red, close to what I made for Celie. And resilient is a deeper berry for Sophia. I've never thought about creating products before, but this story has stayed with me and touched so many lives, including mine. Lipstick is a way to channel it. So we're moving on to a recipe. It's called In a Flurry. This feather boa of a cake brings tropical flavors to the table and is breezy to make, too. The batter goes in a single-rimmed sheet, and you can just cut it into 4 rectangles and stack them. And the actual food is called coconut lime layer cake. For the cake, you will need for the ingredients 10 tablespoons of butter at room temperature, plus more for the baking sheet, 2 cups of cake flour, 1 tablespoon of baking powder, 1 1/4 cups of granulated sugar, 4 large eggs separated at room temperature, 2 teaspoons of pure vanilla extract, and 1/4 cup whole milk at room temperature, 1 cup of toasted unsweetened shredded coconut. For the filling, you could store-bought lime or lemon curd, the frosting, 8 ounces of cream cheese very soft, 8 tablespoons of butter at room temperature, 1 cup of confectioner's sugar, 1 1/2 teaspoons of pure vanilla extract, and 1 1/2 cups of toasted unsweetened shredded coconut. Number 1, prepare the cake. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Butter a 13 by 18 inch rimmed baking sheet. No cake pans required for this 3-layered beauty. Number 2, in a medium bowl, whisk together the cake flour and baking powder in a large bowl with an electric mixer on medium speed. Beat together the butter and 1 cup of the sugar until fluffy, about 3 minutes. Number 3, beat in the egg yolks and vanilla. Beat in half of the flour mixture, then all of the milk, and then the remaining flour mixture. Do not overmix. Fold in the coconut. Number 4, in a large clean bowl with clean beaters, beat the egg whites on medium-high until they are foamy and the yellowish tinge has disappeared. With the mixer on high speed, add the remaining 1/4 cup sugar a little at a time and continue beating until stiff peaks form, about 4 minutes. Stir a spoonful of the beaten egg whites into the batter to loosen it, and then, with a balloon whisk, fold it in the rest of the whites. Number 5. Tip the batter into the prepared baking sheet and carefully spread it into an even layer. Be careful not to overwork the batter so that you don't lose all the air. Bake the cake until it is golden brown and springs back when gently pressed in the center about 20 minutes. Number 6. Transfer to a rack to cool for 15 minutes, then flip the cake out into a stack to cool completely. Slice the cake into 4 13 by 4.5 inch rectangles. Set one piece on a serving plate and top with a third of the lime curd. Spread it evenly. Repeat 2 more times with 2 more cake layers and the remaining lime curd, and then place the remaining piece of cake on top. Cover and chill for at least 1 hour and up to 24 hours. Number 8. Prepare the frosting in a large bowl with an electric mixer on medium. Beat together the cream cheese, butter, confectioner's sugar, and vanilla until smooth. Number 9. Spread the frosting evenly over the top and sides of the cake and press the coconut evenly into the frosting. Number 10. Refrigerate covered until bringing to room temperature for about 30 minutes before serving. Store leftovers well wrapped in the fridge, but let the slices warm up at room temperature before serving. And it serves 8 to 10 people. This is in the health section. How to manage holiday stress. Want to avoid family drama this year? Here are 3 ways to pre-game. Know your limits. According to research by the American Psychiatric Association, 1 in 4 of us worries about spending time with family over the holidays, especially when political discussions are on the menu. There could be tension any time family members with opposing views come together, but throw in a presidential election and a cornucopia of indictments and things can quickly boil over. If you're part of a family who are receptive to feedback, you might try laying down some clear boundaries of what's off the table for discussion in advance, says Morgan Pommels, a trauma therapist who runs an annual master class in dealing with family dynamics over the holiday period. If this isn't the case, then have a safety plan in place. Check with yourself. Do you have the capacity to be part of this triggering conversation? If not, be okay with stepping out for a few minutes to ground and soothe yourself. Plot your escape. Even for families who generally get on well, the cracks can start to show after days of being cooped up together. A study from the University of Michigan showed that just 20 minutes in the great outdoors can lower cortisol levels by more than 20%. So it's a good idea to head out for some fresh air as often as possible. We know that just being outside increases happiness hormones and is one of the best ways to regulate your system, explains Pommels. Going for a brisk walk or doing some yoga in the yard is a great way to relieve holiday stress. It's also great for your cardio health and your digestion. Win, win, win. Breathe like a boss. Sometimes tricky conversations can come up over the turkey and it feels like there's no escape. If a family member is discussing triggering beliefs, you may not always feel up to putting yourself in the line of fire, but trying to change their views, says Pommels. If that's the case, you really need to focus on caring for yourself. Square breathing is a great way to calm the sympathetic nervous system and prevent yourself from going into fight or flight. Simply breathe in for a count of 4. Hold for 4, breathe out for 4, and hold for 4. Repeat until you begin to feel soothed and the conversation has moved on. Mindfulness is another surefire way to keep your cool when your holiday spirit is wearing thin. A recent study demonstrated that regular mindfulness not only reduces acute stress, but also comes with the added benefit of improving heart health. If you're new to meditation, try getting started with an app like Calm or Digital Deepak. This article is Who or What Do You Need to Thank? Gratitude isn't just a topic for your annual turkey dinner. It's been scientifically shown to improve your health, easing depression, boosting immunity, and lowering stress. These thank you notes plus an ode to a heartbreakingly loyal pup will inspire you to make it a daily practice. Dear Public Library, I love you, not just because there are wild roses which I can literally stop and smell growing all around your little stone shelf, or perhaps your chilled entryway is shelved with pay-what-you-like discards for rummaging through, or because of your nerdy owl logo. I love you because your librarians are so kind to me with my excessive enthusiasms and my daily piles at the circulation desk and my overdue notices. It looks like that book on fermented cashew cheese was due back 2 weeks ago, but no worries. But also to the down-and-out folks who pass some time with you, to the kids with nowhere else to go. They are even nice to the teenagers vaping in the self-help stacks. My teenagers vaping in the self-help stacks. For all I know, blowing smoke into the books on how to quit smoking. My kids have been coming to you, dear library, since they were babies, when you hosted Tuesday baby music class with Happy Dan back then. I passed the lonely hours reading parenting books and eyeballing other moms in a weird, hitting-on-them kind of way, while my little pawed at board books played with your train set and contracted neurovirus from stuffing the caboose into their mouths. Now, ordering coffee at the cafe across the street from you, I run into your children's librarian. She's storybook pretty, with angel hair curling auburnly around her angel face, and I blush. Does everyone treat you like a celebrity, I say, and she laughs. Your librarians keep all our secrets, like bartenders we never tip. They know that I checked out 7 books about perimenopausal rage, that I used interlibrary loan to request a book called Mating in Captivity, that I put a hold on both a memoir about microdosing and a study of conjoined twins Chang and Ang. I keep and keep your books, and they are overdue, and I'm sorry. And the librarians, those gracious hosts, would never be so crass as to mention what I'm costing them. Also, they'll cheerily lend a ukulele, a dulcimer, and a glockenspiel, and I have borrowed all 3. I am especially grateful for your books. Novels are the pool and palm tree that I am always crawling through the desert toward. I read with my headlamp on, long into the night, those sweating, sleepless, rage-filled nights. You enable this habit, bless you, and save me approximately $11 trillion in the process. And sometimes, as I'm checking out, a librarian will gesture toward this or that cover and say, "Oh, that's a good one." And I flush with happiness the same way I do when a waiter praises me for ordering the short ribs. Because I am needy. Because you meet that need in so many ways, even if there's no portrait of you in the Annie Leibovitz and coffee table book you lent me. Even if you're not featured in any popular neuroscience book about feel-good brain chemicals, you are the hero of a story, and it's this one. This next one is Dear Chunky. In spring 2014, my best friend, Raya, and that's R-A-Y-Y-A, called with very bad news. She just bought herself an expensive, purebred French bulldog puppy. After her last dog died a few years earlier, rest in peace, Ricky, Raya swore she wouldn't get another pet. She was in her 50s, happily single, never more at peace with life, and didn't want the responsibility. But then she was walking past a pet store in New York City one afternoon, and the owners had put a bunch of adorable puppies in the window, and a tiny little smushed-in white face had stood out among the furry throng. Raya took one glance and fell in love. Next thing you know, she was plunking down thousands of dollars she didn't have on a puppy she named Chunky. I disapproved entirely. First of all, you don't spend a fortune on some creature overbred in a puppy mill. You go to a rescue shelter and adopt, because that's the only moral way. Second, I didn't like Chunky's looks. Forgive me, but I think a dog should come equipped with both a snout and a tail. And he possessed neither. French bulldogs are mutants, once noble canines ruined by humanity's dumb instinct to genetically engineer cuteness. They have an underbite, buggy eyes, respiratory issues, a squatty little body, bow-legged limbs, an unholy combination of pygmy hippo, albino walrus, runty piglet, and Ralph Wiggum. Lastly, Chunky was kind of a bullheaded jerk. I mean, he is French. He wasn't affectionate enough, operating with a cat-like vibe. For 2 years, he mostly stared at me with an air of icy disapproval. I regarded him much the same way. Then in spring 2016, I got a call from Raya with really bad news. She'd been diagnosed with pancreatic and liver cancer, and it was terminal. The bottom fell out of my heart. Raya was more than my best friend. She was my person. We'd known each other for 17 years, and she had become my anchor, my protector, my hero, my source of joy and comfort. She was my first phone call in the times of emergencies or celebration. She was the one person in the world I felt I could not live without. And now she was going to die. After her diagnosis, I was forced to confront an inconvenient truth, which is that Raya was the love of my life. I had loved her for years but kept it under wraps, even to myself in some ways, because I was married and didn't want to cross that line. But I couldn't let her die without being honest about who she really was to me. So I told her. She told me she loved me too. I left my marriage to move in with Raya and be with her at last. It all happened very quickly. Everyone could see this truth between us. What followed over the next 18 months was a beautiful, horrible story of love and loss. But it's one for another day. Today we're talking about Chunky. At first, Chunky and I were obviously not so psyched to be living together. We saw each other, I think, as rivals for Raya's attention. I had trouble sleeping in Raya's bed because he slept there too. Of course, French bulldogs snore. Yet, as Raya got sicker and weaker, I took over Chunky's care. I bathed him, fed him, cleaned the junk out of his eyes. Of course, French bulldogs always have junk in their eyes. And I walked him. I have always needed to take daily walks to clear my head. And Chunky turned out to be a terrific walking companion. Soon that little truffle pig and I were logging 5 miles a day. I guess he's okay, I thought. He seemed to think something similar about me. He began sleeping on my side of the bed. Then Raya got really sick. There were strangers coming in and out of the house. Nurses, doctors, panicked friends. Disease and drugs and pain altered the way Raya acted, walked, smelled, spoke. There was a period when she became angry and hard. She was so pissed to be dying, and she went wild in her rage. Chunky became afraid of her, and for a while, forgive me, Raya, so did I. Thank God Chunky needed his many walks, is all I can say. 4 times a day I was forced to leave the apartment full of death and sadness and take Chunky into the bright, fresh air. Without him, I never would have left Raya's side, and that would have been terrible for me and her. Death is a personal experience, and sometimes people just need to be alone with their dying to feel it for themselves. In her final 2 months, Raya grew gentle and tender again. She was so beautiful. I'd never seen such luminescence in a face. She didn't want to go, but knew she had to. Chunky and I would lie with her in bed for hours, just gazing at her. Raya mostly slept, but she was so happy when she woke, knowing we were both there. She didn't ask if I'd take care of him after she died. We all knew I would. When somebody you love is close to death, your world becomes terribly small. At the end, my world had become the size of the bed upon which she lay. But because of those 4 daily walks, I was able to remember that I still belonged to the world of the living, a world of trees, a world of sky, a world that did not have cancer. On the day before Raya died, Chunky needed 4 walks. On the day she died, he needed 4 walks. On the day after she died, and on the day of her funeral, and on the day of her cremation, he needed 4 walks. And in the 10 months since the love of my life died, Chunky has taken me out nearly 800 times. My life cannot collapse into a dark world of grief because his cannot. I must go on because this guy needs to go out. We take our walks and strangers swoon over him. I say, his name is Chunky and he's the best. Chunky is handsome and brave and loyal and wise. He sleeps in my arms. We spend every moment of the day together. When she bought that puppy, maybe Raya was just following some divine instruction, getting the dog for me as solace for after she was gone. I don't know. I don't know how anything works. I'm just grateful for the woman Chunky and I both loved, and for his life and mine. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This next article is Dear Acrylic Nails. Before you came into my life, when I used to meet someone for the first time, I'd jam my hands in my pockets to avoid a handshake, worried the person would notice my chewed nails and the cuticles I'd picked to shreds. Nail biting was a sort of hard-edged self-soothing, a painful but effective way to expend uneasy energy. I bit my nails below the quick, so low that cold air made my fingertips sting. Periodically, I'd swear off my addiction, wear white spa gloves around the house, and give myself preventative manicures, but I could not, would not, stop. Then one day, while I was sitting at a Starbucks worrying over grad school applications, a man I didn't know came up to tell me I looked terribly gnawing on my thumbnail. My eyes filled with tears. I'd never felt more exposed. Biting my nails was like hanging a neon sign around my neck that read, "To cope, I hurt myself." A friend once told me, "If you want to stop biting your nails, get acrylic ones." I'd always resisted, thinking of the corn-chip-esque talons my mom's colleagues sported during my childhood, the ones she'd disdainfully called secretary nails. I was way too outdoorsy and low maintenance for those. But weeks after weeping in that Starbucks, I found myself watching in rapt horror as a manicurist sanded my nails until they were paper thin, glued on plastic tips, and then painted over the whole mess with toxic-smelling liquid and a pink powder. I'm talking about you, acrylic nails. At first, your presence was panic-inducing, like a wig I couldn't rip off. But since you were impossible to bite through, believe me, I tried, and made a grasping onto hang nails so clumsy I miraculously quit picking. One morning I looked at fingers I'd long known as ratty, torn, and bleeding, and saw that they'd transformed into those of someone calm and pulled together. I came to think of you as my very own version of Wonder Woman's bulletproof cuffs. But while those shining bands keep others from hurting her, you protect me from myself, and you help me present a less assailable self to the world. Now, when I'm uneasy, I sit on my meditation cushion, I text a friend, I write a list of my worries and fears and read it to a loved one, then burn it. I go to CrossFit and lift weights high above my head before sending them crashing to the ground. From the inside out and from the outside in, I work through the feelings that had me gnawing on myself. Then I let them go. This article is called Dear IRS Auditor. I know you're not expecting this, but thanks. Really. If you hadn't mistakenly overcharged me in the fall of 2012, I might never have woken up. I'll admit it was a huge shock the day I opened the unassuming white envelope containing your final assessment to find I owed you $50,000, as opposed to the few hundred dollars my accountant had predicted. Then again, I hadn't spoken to the guy in months, maybe a whole year. That was how I was then, utterly checked out. At the time, I was grieving the sudden death of my 22-year-old daughter and moving in protracted slow motion. I was so devastated that I'd closed my marketing coaching business and was living on savings in the pastel comfort of a friend's guest room. Each and every day, I woke up and lay there staring at the ceiling, not sure how or why to get out of bed. You seemed like a nice young woman when I picked up my files from your suburban office, the unmarked white door nearly obscured by a gargantuan American flag hanging limp on a pole. Standing there in jeans and a flannel shirt, you asked, "Do you have any questions?" I was so terrified to be on the IRS sterile, fluorescent-like turf that I couldn't think clearly. I could barely think at all. But finally, I remembered a couple of critical queries. Had my accountant ever discussed my bill with you? And who'd calculated that my business earned $200,000 more than it actually had? You were downright empathetic when you said, "We called your accountant, but I'm afraid he never got back to us." Money had always been an intimidating blur to me, and the IRS a fearsome, shadowy giant. But that day I decided to go through the appeals entirely on my own. In the weeks that followed, I slowly assembled page after page of deposit slips, invoices, receipts, and canceled checks, tucking them carefully into a massive 3-ring binder. As I did, something shifted in me. The process had shown up like an invitation, requesting I return to the world of thinking adults, and it felt surprisingly good. When the appeals officer looked over my handiwork months later, he was impressed. "These are Wall Street quality books," he noted with a smile, and after a few hours he called to inform me you'd made an error. I owed nothing. Molten relief and pride poured through my limbs. I was awake again, moving forward. Thanks to your mistake, the long, slow slog of grief eased just a little, allowing me to discover an unexpected truth. I had been through hell, but I was going to be fine. This one is Dear Tiny Balled Up Fist. The first time I saw you was on a screen in my midwife's office. You were tucked under my second baby's chin. Past my due date, I willed you and the baby attached to you to evacuate the premises immediately. When my water broke a few days later, I was thrilled and terrified. My 2-year-old son slept soundly in the next room, and memories of my first C-section and my fear of another surged inside me in the delivery room. I bounced for hours on that birthing ball, but no matter how much I jostled myself, I never dilated beyond the size of a Skittle. My baby would not budge. Hours were spent with my own fist tucked under my chin, contemplating my options. I waved my white flag and was wheeled to the operating room for another C-section. On my side of the curtain draped across my torso, I trembled and cried. Then I heard the cry. The doctors lifted my baby above the curtain, and I saw both her fists balled up in anger over this immense disturbance. She was placed on my chest, and as I was stitched up, I stroked her back and held tiny fist in my hand. I brought you to my face for the first of many kisses. When my daughter was born, I didn't see her on the other side of the curtain. I didn't know that the umbilical cord was wrapped tight around her neck several times, but she tucked you, all 5 red, wrinkly fingers wrapped in a miniature palm under her chin, beneath the cord. You protected her. You kept her airway clear. Without you, things in that bright operating room could have gone terribly, terribly wrong. Now 3 years old, she still sleeps with you under her chin, her other hand lovingly cradled a stuffed giraffe. When I smooth back her blonde hair to nuzzle her forehead as she falls asleep, I'm reminded of how thankful I am for you. Those red, wrinkly fingers are now pudgy and fair, with a palm that's becoming adept at petting our rescue mutt. I smile when she gives me an ebullient high five, remembering the enormous gift one small hand gave me. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Dear Sprained Ankle, what in God's name were you thinking dropping in on me at the age of 16, humiliating me beyond humiliation? There I was, a 5'2", round, athletically challenged girl from Kansas. For months I had trained for Outboard, Bound, the famously life-altering expedition where I would scale the Colorado Rockies, rappel down sheer-faced cliffs, and brave 3 days solo in the wilderness. After 28 days, I would rise like a phoenix, sun-kissed, six-packed, armed with stories to impress for a lifetime. It was my destiny. The first day, I stood in a circle with my fellow adventurers. Then the whistle blew for our 3-mile run to base camp. 10 seconds later, I jumped onto a rock and snap. I couldn't believe it. I didn't believe it until the patrol leader held my foot in his hand. "There's no way you can do this course," he said, looking up at me with dark wonder. Wow, this is a first. 6 hours later, I was staring out an airplane window in a stupor of shame, headed home to Prairie Village. My parents consoled me as I healed, then shipped me off several weeks later to a month-long teen travel program in Israel. It was me and 40 teenagers from Long Island. Them, a tornado of Farrah Fawcett blowouts, leg warmers, and massive suitcases containing several clothing changes per day. Me, a lone Midwestern hayseed in track shorts, clutching my puny duffel bag. I was paired with golden-haired Jessie, a bronzed queen bee whose breezy laugh and hot pink bikini made me feel like a loaf of Wonder Bread. But as the days passed, Jessie's velvet heart dissolved my insecurities. Together we sneaked into fields to pick pears, bargained our way through noisy city markets, and rode the glittering waves of the Mediterranean Sea. That summer turned out to be one of the best of my life. The next year, Jessie became my college roommate, then my New York City BFF, and after one long work day, she cajoled me into a margaritas at a Greenwich Village dive bar. That night I met my future husband, with whom I eventually had two treasured children. 3 decades later, Jessie and I remain one another's touchstones. And so, sprained ankle, I need to express my gratitude. Thank you for leading me to everything that defines meaning and magic in my life today. And thank you for teaching me on that horrible, humiliating day one whopper of an eventual lesson, that life is not linear, that 2 + 2 so rarely equals 4, and that what looks like misery in the moment just may be part of life's larger, wondrous plan. This next article is called The Mother-in-Law Survival Guide. Ding dong, she's here! But fear not, so are we, with advice on managing this singular relationship with grace, humor, and lots of heart. My mother-in-law was the easiest person to buy presents for. All she ever wanted was an abundance of alone time with my husband, Jamie. 1 year, she actually asked for 36 holes of golf with him, and only him, which shakes down to at least 8 hours, not including the inevitable extra few hours practicing their swings on the range beforehand or tossing back a few drinks at the 19th hole afterward. She really adored him. Drinking up time with him, but also just plain drinking with him. Do I even need to say that that situation is the opposite of what exists in my own family, where long stretches of together time happen only with a TV and a Coke Zero nearby? Which is why it struck me as so foreign and unexpected and, I'll say it, wrong. Of course it wasn't wrong, it was just different from what I was used to. Families are microcultures. Explains Christine E. Kunkel, that's K-U-N-K-L-E, Ph.D., a professor in communication studies at West Virginia University, who has researched family and mother-in-law/daughter-in-law relationships. Our patterns of behavior, our ways of doing rituals, it's like water to a fish, she says. You don't necessarily notice it because you're swimming in it all the time. But when you're dropped into someone else's water, you notice every little difference, every tiny little bothersome bit of flotsam. To further that analogy, your fishbowl probably looks very different from your mother-in-law's due to generational differences. I had to work all the time when my kids were little, my friend Allie, not her real name, says. As a former stay-at-home mom, my mother-in-law had opinions about that. As tempting as it is, Kunkel suggests that fixating on the generational divide, it instantly increases our odds of thinking in us versus them way, which creates distance. She says it oversimplifies people, and it's not great for relationships. Another thing to let go, if you can, the trope of the hostile in-law relationship with all its baggage and bad punchlines. I think both parties, the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law, go into the relationship with expectations, says a therapist. Nedra Glover Tawab, T-A-W-W-A-B, author of Drama Free. Even before you meet, you think this is how this person should be. A better approach, she says, is to imagine the relationship without the title. Pretend you're walking into a relationship with a coworker that has lower stakes, right? Whether you're new to your in-law relationship or years in, remember it may very well last decades, so act accordingly. This is a family created by marriage, says Elaine Swan, founder of the Swan School of Protocol in Carlsbad, California, and author of Let Crazy Be Crazy. When there's conflict, you want to give a thoughtful response. When there is confrontation, it's so important that there is resolution at the end of it, she says. You can't always fix everything, but you can approach it like we're going to get through it. To that end, here are ways to address and navigate some common and challenging mother-in-law archetypes with humor, heart, and grace, while also maintaining your sense of self and not being a total doormat or a total shrew. It bears mentioning that plenty of women have truly wonderful, meaningful relationships with their MILs, to which we say, huzzah, all around there. But also, you may want to prepare to someday be an excellent mother-in-law yourself. Turn to page 103 and go straight to the head of the class. So jumping over to page 103, how to be a great mother-in-law. Okay, now it's your turn. No pressure. As you approach this role of a lifetime, you, of course, want to keep your own experience in mind. Remember what it was like to be your child-in-law's age, says Tawab. Remember that you wanted to create your own family and your own traditions and your own rules for your house, even if you didn't have the courage to do it. Hopefully that will motivate you enough to respect this new person when they want something different from what you want. At the early stage of your kid's marriage, there is a window, a small window, where the spouse is looking to connect with you, looking for your approval, Swan says. Use that moment wisely and be brutally honest without being brutal. State your expectations and values and get it all out on the table. Express your wishes for holiday traditions. Say, or how often you'd like to visit or even travel together. Perhaps most important, find some commonality to bond over that has nothing to do with your child, Swan suggests. Could be gardening. Could be true crime podcasts, antiquing, or books. It could be any of the excellent, tasty, drama-fueled shows on Bravo. Israel Housewives, American Women's Lingua Franca? The point is, try to find a connection that is not tethered to your child, and it will bridge any awkward moments. And going back over, here are some of the challenges of mother-in-laws. The nosy Nancy, how she behaves. The biped beta version of the Google Nest doorbell, this woman tries not to miss a trick with the comings, goings, and goings-on in your life. Never one to phone when she can FaceTime, or FaceTime when she can swing by, she wants to see it all, hear it all, know it all, and isn't shy about asking. Now, how big was your raise, and what date was your last period, or even worse, ovulation? How to handle her. Start with your partner and make sure you agree on the topics that are fair game and the ones that are private. Because if she's asking you something deeply personal because your spouse started the conversation, she's not the one at fault. When she probes, Kunkel grants full permission to not answer. Tell her you appreciate that she cares, but you don't feel comfortable giving personal information, Kunkel suggests, then gently redirect the conversation. Lastly, don't gobble up her gossip about others, thereby condoning her nosiness. Deflect, Tawab says. Maybe you say, gosh, that sounds so tough, I really feel for them. Then you're not roped into the drama. The oversharer. How she behaves. The whole world is this woman's municipal gym locker rooms. She sees not a single thing wrong with carrying on a lengthy conversation while standing two-thirds naked in her bass drum carrier of a bra and threadbare undies with the blown-out leg elastic. When you ask her what she did last weekend, she performs dramatic readings of chats from her coffee meets, bagel matches, then moves on to tell tales out of school about her no-good ex, her other kids, or the ultimate indiscretion another daughter-in-law. How to handle her. Though she pushes all your cringe buttons, this is simply her way of opening up, suggests Terry L. Orbuch, O-R-B-U-C-H, Ph.D., a professor of sociology at Michigan's Oakland University, who's been following the same married couples and their in-laws for 30 years. She wants to get closer, Orbuch says. If you can shift that in your head, it will likely be easier to deal with. Beyond that, Kunkel recommends warm phrasings that acknowledge her while also deftly tamping down the TMI. I love that you're comfortable enough to share that with me. I love that you trust me with that, she suggests. And if you want, you can toss in, I just want to tell you that in my background, we didn't share that type of information. Then nudge the conversation where you want it to go so you open a new door instead of just closing the door on her, Kunkel says. The guilt tripper. How she behaves. Who is that shadowy figure sitting in your cold, darkened home waiting for the furniture delivery? Your mother-in-law, who doesn't want to run up your electric bill by turning on the heat or lights, but she doesn't want it to go unmentioned that she shivered in the gloaming of your dining room for 3 hours. And yes, of course, Tracy Flick raised her hand to do this favor. She texts to ask how vacation is without her, even though you're still waiting to board the plane, and that will fly you to see your own parents for a holiday. How to handle her. She may find it disarming, but meet her indirectness with directness. Ask questions that encourage her to be clear about what she wants, Kunkel says. You can even say things like, you're making me feel guilty that I'm... From there, Kunkel suggests, explain why you can't do what she is guilting you about. The key is, it's out in the open and spoken aloud. The good time girl. How she behaves. Before 4 p.m., this one can be found loitering near the ice maker so she can add cubes to that monster goblet of Chardonnay, which she tops off all afternoons, thereby giving her plausible deniability by her fuzzy logic, anyhow, that she only had one glass. After 4 p.m., she's loitering near the liquor cabinet, shuffling a deck of cards with one hand while looking to drum up a game. Glamma also loves tossing your kids on the back of a souped-up ATV, golf cart, or ride-on mower and insisting, I didn't use, fill in the blank with any safety necessity pioneered since 1967, back in the day, and look how I turned out. How to handle her. When it comes to drinking or the safety of your kids or yourself, you have to assert that you are choosing to do things differently, Tawab says. Maybe she didn't want to put her kids in her car seats or get her kids to school on time, and you're happy your partner survived that. But it's not the sort of thing you want to take a gamble with. Orbuch also recommends a well-deployed, I'm not comfortable with that, for its door-shutting conversation-ending properties. You can say, I understand that you like that, and I love that about you, but I'm not comfortable. After that, she really can't come back with anything. The boss. How she behaves. This woman is Washington crossing the Delaware. The rest of the family are her obedient oarsmen, throwing their backs and hearts into whatever her task may be. Cleaning out the garage, posing for a group photo, opening presents on Christmas morning, often the tiny woman walking at the front of a V formation of strapping sons. She's also always offers two options for doing things, her way and also her way. How to handle her. In families, people want to feel useful, even if you think she oversteps in your own home, for especially when you think she oversteps. Give this woman a clearly defined job whenever you can, Kunkel says. Bonus points if it lends her on an air of authority, like setting the holiday table and deciding where everyone sits, or marshaling everyone at the family reunion into a bunch of Ubers with her legendary military precision. However, if she's exerting authority about something you simply cannot agree to, Orbuch says to tell her you recognize where she's coming from and add a clear but friendly boundary setter like, I'll handle this one. The judge. How she behaves. This lady wields an imaginary gavel with her pursed lips and cocked eyebrows. She starts observations about anything from how you butter corn to how you bathe your kids with, are you really going to... She lets you know that she saw those posts on Instagram, but doesn't add anything more than the general yet persuasive vibe that you've brought dishonor to her good name. She also loves to deploy a nice, juicy, "I'm not saying in anything," while making clear the power of her judgment. Only chumps and amateurs need to vocalize it to convey it. How to handle her? First, grant her something like the benefit of the doubt, says Orbuck. It's not always malicious intent. Could be she's judgy about something because that's all she knows. That's what she grew up with it. That's how she's parenting her kids, Orbuck says. From there, toss her an "I hear you" or "I understand what you're saying" that shows you've acknowledged her opinions, even if you're not acting on them. You don't even have to agree, and you don't have to change, but validating her input will tone down the tension, she says. In a tizzy, send a text. There was a time not so very long ago that phones were attached to cords, and when they rang, it was anyone's guess who was on the other end, and sometimes it might be your mother-in-law. Today, technology is on our side, as difficult conversations are, well, difficult, and they can get your emotions surging and your words sputtering. Kunkel gives full permission to express your feelings via text. Take advantage of the asynchronous nature where you can gather your thoughts, save a draft, and revise as needed, she says. Also, give a literal stage direction for your tone. She suggests prefacing your message with, "I want you to imagine me saying this calmly and kindly." The jealous ex. How she behaves. By turns sulky and strident, she makes it crystal clear that your beloved was her beloved first, and vice versa, thank you very much. Lady loves, loves, loves an inside joke, warily insisting that it's too much to explain and reminding you that it was long before your time. When you start taking an Owen Hocken cooking class, so does she, incorporating 47 ingredients into her mole to your paltry 39. You can shake the feeling that no matter what you do, she group texts her friends about it. How to handle her? A little fawning goes a long way. Her jealousy and insecurity may come from the feeling like she's not getting enough attention. Orbach points out, so toss her a bone and make her feel special. "Oh, I love your haircut. Is that a new dress? I love the glasses," Orbach suggests. Another option? Simply cede your time with your partner, as I did with Jamie's 36 holes of golf. Think of it as free alone time for you. When you step into people's families, we have to acknowledge the relationships they've already had, Tawab explains. It may not be problematic for them, it's just problematic for you to observe. For instance, if it irks you that she calls your partner to come over and fix every little thing in her house, and he's doing it joyfully like it never occurred to him to be upset about it, yeah, you might be the problem then. Here are some noteworthy novel suggestions. Absolution by Alice McDermott. You have no idea what it was like for us, the women, I mean, the wives. The year was 1963, the city, Saigon. Patricia was newly married to an engineer working for the military and spent her days ignoring artillery blasts and attending garden parties. 60 years later, the next generation has questions, and Patricia has the benefit of hindsight. This is the Vietnam we never got in history class, a story of innocence lost, womanhood tested, and our nation held to account. This next one is called The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride. Set in Pottstown, Chicken Hill, this energetic novel written by James McBride, author of the 85th Oprah's Book Club pick, explores the complexities of a black and Jewish community in the 1930s. Though set up as a mystery, complete with a dead body, the story finds its footing in Dodo, the deaf, parentless boy hidden by locals from officials attempting to put him in a home for the insane. Heartwarming and heartbreaking, a feat of language, life, and imagination. The Last Animal by Ramona Ozubel. This compulsively readable story begins in Siberia, where recently widowed paleobiologist Jane has lugged her two teenage daughters on a research trip. a startling discovery lands the grieving trio in a castle in Italy, trying to implant a woolly mammoth embryo into the womb of an eccentric couple's pet elephant. A wildly entertaining adventure and a meditation on what it means to love your child in the age of extinction. So we have some of Oprah's favorite things. One is called Our Cup Runneth Over. This ethically sourced coffee, 8-ounce bags each of Motherland, East 14th, and Carver's Dream flavors, is roasted in small batches in Oakland, California for a smooth taste. The holiday gift set is $33 at redbaycoffee.com. Another one is Beauty and the Beads. Budding jewelry designers can make one necklace or two bracelets with this fun kit. It's also a popular stocking stuffer or Hanukkah gift. Make it Purple Mini Bead Kit. It's $19 at supermalls.com. Okay, this favorite thing is called Letter Perfect. It's so hard to find a gift that works for, say, tweens to aunties, but these handcrafted sterling silver or 14-karat gold-plated initial necklaces with, yes, real diamonds at this price will add sparkle to all ages. So it's one big, like, capital letter of the alphabet. Necklaces, originally $150 to $8 each, are now 20% off with code Oprah at AmeliaRoseJewelry.com. That's AmeliaRoseJewelry.com. And we have Oh Baby. My friends Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union were inspired by their daughter to create this line of hydrating baby lotion, all-over balm and nourishing oil for melanated kids and babies. Moisture layering gift set was $35, now 20% off with the code Oprah at proudly.com. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.